Thank you. As far as I know, Dr. Carter is on his way, so we should record about within a few minutes. Thank you.
Not covered by Mr. Andrew. I know Mr. Singh has indicated he wants to leave early. I know Ms. Carter also wants to leave early, and Mr. McLaughlin, what is early? 12 o'clock? I would be out at 12 o'clock, so yes, thank you. Mr. Singh?
Yes, Your Honor, I think we've received the presentation, and as you say, maybe next week we can find a few minutes to adopt, because they need the resolutions, but we should receive the presentation. But it's only four. Only three. We need four. As you can't think yourself as a book.
Let's hand over to AG. Just to indicate that our last meeting, AG, we had tentatively approved the appointment of auditors on condition we received a letter from the audit committee. Mr. Remrock was within my ear that indeed we've received that. So just for the record, members will recall that at our last meeting we had said it's tentative, but we have received that letter. So tentative now moves to full confirmation on that one. So whatever we approve next week will be outside of that agreement, because we've received the letter. We will then deal with whatever else comes out today if needs be. Mr. Mabetta, up to you. Over to you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to the member of the committee. Chair, just as a quick wrap-up from last time that we met, I'm going to try and rearrange the order of the issues that we're going to speak to now. I'm going to start just to give some feedback, Chair, on two areas in addition to what we spoke about the last time. When we spoke to the committee in Johannesburg, when we were reporting on our annual report, a couple of matters stood out that we said we will come back to the committee on. So I just want to make sure that we dispense with those specific matters before we look ahead in respect of the 2016 onwards strategic plan. The two issues, Chair, were the data, which I see is already on the agenda, and B, as well as the utilization of retained surpluses from the time that the surplus approval was granted about a year or two, I think, ago. On the data front, we have prepared an assessment, especially when we looked at a deeper level with regards to what is the status of the amounts that are owing largely by municipalities. As we recall, municipalities had been owing quite a substantial amount from the audit fees that had been billed to them. And one of the key things standing out as we speak now in our annual report and in our financial statements is the large balances with regard to the accounts that are owing by municipalities. So we went through a couple of areas over a period of the last year and so on, where, among others, we ring-fenced certain debtors that were outstanding for a long period of time, and we shared a detailed report of this one as well with the committee. It's just an update on what we experienced and what we propose going forward. So as far as the ring-fencing of long-outstanding debts is concerned, we had quite a number of debtors that were ring-fenced, just about a total of about 36. With agreement for amounts totaling about 121 as at the 30th of September 2015. About 62% of that has already been paid, which is roughly about 81 million of the amount that has been ring-fenced out of a total of 131. So at least we are seeing some progress in regards to the old outstanding amounts. When we ring-fence them, we actually enter into specific agreements with the amounts owing, and we gradually collect it based on those agreements. There are others that we have taken steps to issue summonses, and when once we started escalating the area of taking the litigation route, we also started seeing some recoveries in that area. For example, the total amount was subjected to this process of about 157 million, of which to date about 43% has been recovered through the litigation process. So those instruments that are defined in the Public Audit Act, which require us to escalate the effort, are being put in place and some steady progress compared to the history of these deaths, some of them owing for more than 4 or 5 years in certain municipalities. At least that part is starting to bear fruit. We are also looking at the whole area of fees with more scrutiny, Chair. And when I say with more scrutiny, we are looking at different categories of municipalities and starting to identify how best can we look at them from a fee generation point of view. And I think the discussion that we are triggered in the office, which still has to be finalized, is about saying that certain of them we can afford to charge them less than what the true cost of doing that work is. And I think that's the logic that we are trying to apply. Because the reality is that when people see that a municipality's fee that is being charged is 50,000 rands, for argument's sake, then sometimes they mobilize the resources equal to 50,000, which means that the risks that the audit ought to focus on, some of them might be missed on the back of trying to charge a less amount of money. So we are starting to go through that process to say that let us put on the table that it costs 150,000 to do this audit. However, based on our understanding of other considerations, we think that we will put a bill of 80,000 for argument's sake instead of the full 150. So that's the exercise we're going through. We've already quantified a certain amount, and I think it will be fair for us just to quantify this and finalize it internally before we get the committee to look at whether this is a strong enough medicine that we're applying. The third element that we're looking at in the long term is to begin to go through a study. This is more now to deal with it in the medium to long term, to begin to look at a study between ourselves and National Treasury and whoever else, to say what would be the standard costing that would be required to charge audit fees on different categories of entities, considering issues of risk, considering issues of the methodology, and considering issues of the resources and efficiencies in an audit. So that one is pretty much a medium to long-term engagement, so that we can get to a standard that says typical size audit like a Department of Defense could potentially be done with this kind of standard costing guideline in terms of the parameters of hours, the parameters of rates, and all sorts of things. So that's the part that we are also looking at. But I think the underlying theme for us is that whatever we do in terms of the recovery of the court fees, the underlying theme must be that the base disciplines of rigor in executing an audit must continue to be in place. So we are working with that. Obviously, it will have an impact financially because it will mean that for certain of the processes, we will be recovering less. However, if we make sure that we maintain a basic governance over that process, say that regardless of what we did, we will make sure that when we express an opinion, it's done adequate level of work. So that's the feedback, Chair, as far as the data part is concerned, and we are hoping that we will have an opportunity to present in the current year what the early impact of that initiative is going to be. Another side of the feedback, Chair, from last time was the retention of surplus. And we said we will share with the committee the work that had been undertaken with regards to the spending on the surplus. That's the history of the surplus, Chair. Prior to 2008, the office had been largely writing in red ink, so to speak, with a significant postponement of investment in capital infrastructure and related expenditure because of those losses that we had been incurring. Until in that year, in 2008, we made a submission for a revised approach to the funding model, which started triggering some positive surpluses over the last 3 to 4 years, thereabouts. So we ended up with an accumulated surplus then at that time, which was about 449 million accumulated over a number of years that were preceded by losses that we spent another 6 or 7 years. So we have put together, and I'm not sure if it has been shared with the committee, the schedule. It hasn't. The schedule of the key initiatives that we had undertaken towards the expenditure of the surplus. However, we wanted to also underline that as we look at the key areas which are largely in the information and communication technology, the human capital related projects, if you think about it, we were somewhere around 2,400 employees those days when we were still incurring losses, against 3,500 odd now, which means that issues of accommodation projects, expansion and moving to new premises as we are growing as an institution and other related projects, and as we want that surplus had gone towards. However, we also want to underline the reality that having had these many years of outstanding debt, the bulk of what was in surplus in the income statements in the bank, it has not yet arrived. So the bulk of that surplus, if you look at it, was largely also locked in the accounts receivable that we have been planning to collect. Hence, this particular approach, some of it is starting to gradually come in. So as we look at it, we look at it as a number of 449 that over the years would have been committed to projects, but not all of it had already been paid in the bank because of the outstanding debts that I just spoke about earlier. So, Chair, I think what we'll do is, if the schedule, just for the record, is not shared with the committee, I'll just thought I'd give a high-level feedback on this. We will then give the secretariat the copy of the schedule so that they can get a record of how that surplus is being utilized now. Right, that dispenses with those two key issues which I thought were important, Chair, to give feedback on as we conclude the reporting process for the 2014-2015 year.
Okay, because that's the report back and those were pretty straightforward. Do the members want to deal with that quickly? The debtors, the fee structure and the surplus? Because those should be very straightforward and some of the members want to talk to those. Mr. Singh?
Chair, yeah, thank you very much. Good morning again. I think it's commendable that the debt is reducing to the extent it is. But I'm also glad that the AG is going to present to the committee a way forward in terms of how you're going to assist some of the municipalities. Because there might be small municipalities who are defined in a particular category, but who are mismanaging funds. And, you know, you cannot reward them for that by reducing their audit fees. But I think we'll watch the space as we move forward in terms of looking at the what model comes up to assist those that are really in trouble all the time for cogent reasons. And then on the retention of surplus, I think we understand, but moving forward we'll also have to see that, you know, the surplus is used for specific projects within the broad office of the AG.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, what is a bit of, you know, what's a bit of a concern to me is that municipalities are acting on summonses. This actually, at the end of the day, or, you know, any entity, that is extra cost, which they will not really be able to afford if they haven't paid in, you know, the first instance. So I don't know if it's possible to actually provide us with a list of everyone that is still owing, and then also the ones that actually paid on summons. Thank you.
All right, AG will respond to those. Is there anybody else?
No.
AG, just from my side, I think following up on what Ms. Kass has said, you know, if you can get a sense of what you regard as surplus, because if I'm understanding what you're saying, we categorize it as surplus, but sometimes the money is not even in the bank yet. So it might be a false sense that you're saying you've got, for instance, 50 million surplus, when in truth, you've probably got 20 million surplus, and the others we are keeping our fingers crossed that that's the money that we're going to come. So if you could just differentiate that for us, that would assist us. And then on the debtors, I think let's take it as Mr. Singh indicates, but we're concerned about the age. You know, we'd like an age analysis. I mean, if there's a debtor that's outstanding for 5 years, we have to take a decision, is really going to pay us, or what is it that's going to be done, because it's a reflection on you, it's a reflection on everybody that is outstanding there. So I think in principle we're happy with the approach that's going, but we want to be on top of it all the time. It doesn't require a meeting, but if you give us, we'll share it with members as and when there are changes from your side. If you could forward that to us, we'll share it with members. And just an oversight on my side, before we do that, so just for us to, for record purposes. Surplus, we are comfortable. We're just asking for additional information for our own purposes. Is that correct? All right. So we'll take that then as a decision, because we are now a quorum, at least for taking decisions on the surplus. So that is done and dusted. If you can just keep us up to date as things change. And certainly with the debtors, as Mr. Singh says, if you could give us, and Ms. Carter, just some indication of maybe the real bad performers or the stubborn, I'm using stubborn in inverted commas, so that we can see what can be done. Because indeed, if somebody is failing to pay ordered fees but is underspending or has raised an expenditure, we need to pronounce on it, certainly in the municipalities. But what I wanted to say earlier on, so that is done and dusted. In terms of the feedback, we are taking a decision that we are accepting it. I wanted, on behalf of the committee, I think to congratulate you. I read somewhere that the AG's office resisted a bribe from a department in Gauteng. Literally, HOD said, here's some money, don't write what you wrote. And that was resisted by the AG's office. We picked that up. So I think it is just proper for us to commend you on that one. Because we'll beat you up when we find another one where you indeed take a bribe to sweeten, or you take a sweetener to change the audit opinion. But in this case where you resisted it, I think we should congratulate you. And on the behalf of the committee, I think you should be going to that person and indicate that at Parliament level, we certainly are keeping tabs on what you're doing, and we commend their principled stance in that instance in Gauteng. So, well done. AG, right, you can carry on the rest of your... you could respond to some of these, and then you can carry on.
Thank you, sir. Thanks very much also for those warm words of encouragement. We certainly will convey the message. We are also internally in the organization taking note of this matter and sharing it with the rest of the colleagues across the organization to see here's what characterizes what a public auditor ought to be under any circumstances. And we think that is an important message to reinforce our independence. As well as I think our independence is not largely the stuff that we pronounce. I think what's important is when we can demonstrate how the people act in situations where they are put under pressure. So certainly we'll convey that message. Chair, just thought I'll take note of the comments that the members raised with a view to committing to come back on those areas that we have been asked to provide additional information. Certainly we do have it. We will make sure that we transmit it to the committee accordingly. Just one, I thought I will try and illustrate, Chair, maybe the issue about the sellers and the money that has yet hit the bank. If I can use an illustration for it, and if we assume that we only had 1 million rands worth of sales in the current year, and we had expenses of 400,000 immediately in the income statement, that is a surplus of 600,000, the million less than 400,000. So we close the books, nothing else happened. One transaction, surplus 600 million. For that revenue of 1 million that we recognized in our books, we may obviously have extended credit for it. If all of those people under that 1 million had not paid by the closing of the books at the end of the year, we still have a surplus of 600 million, but we don't have a rand in the bank. That's the point I was trying to illustrate. That's what we do with when it comes to these debtors. Because if 800,000 of that has been paid by the time we close the books, we've got a surplus of 600, and we've got cash of 800,000, which is much more than the surplus had there been no other transaction that took place. So those are the differences that we are dealing with. So in a situation like ours, yeah, where we deal with the hope that a payment will be made, in most instances, those bills that had gone straight to the surplus, because that's an income statement item, the revenue, in terms of the invoices that were raised, against which we pay whatever expenses we incur, that gives us the surplus. But until the first time that the people that were invoiced have come forward and deposited their payment. That money is still sitting in debtors as an amount expected to be paid, but has not yet been received. So that's the context in which I was trying to differentiate between these 449 of accumulated surpluses over the years, is the difference between the revenue and the expenses incurred. However, that revenue which was expected to be paid has not yet been received, even though payments for those expenses have already been made to the suppliers. And that's where the cash flow difference comes into the equation. So I hope that will plant a seed in our minds as we look at what this surplus is made up of in terms of its core content from a cash flow point of view.
Before you move on, so in terms of surplus, we all understand how it works. All of us, there's no discussion.
I do understand, but I think also a person needs to look a little bit further, because if you have a look at once you balance it with your outstanding debtors, so the surplus, what we are saying, is not actually cash on hand.
Yeah.
But then I think just in future, if we actually put it, this is the cash on hand, but with the surplus we understand, but yeah.
Okay. All right.
Absolutely. So that we are very clear on that it's a book entry. It's not really money sitting in the bank that they're holding onto and charging or overcharging municipalities. Because that's the price that we normally have. How do they have a surplus and yet they're charging? So as long as we all understand that and we are comfortable. And I think for the sake of protecting the AG, if we understand it, we are able to raise it when people raise, because people don't understand it as we understand it. That's why I insisted that at least we understand that this surplus is not real money in the bank. It's a hope and pray in many instances. All right. That having then been dealt with, AG, we will now not interrupt you until you're done, and we will then engage. So members will take notes.
All right.
Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't know who's driving the bus. You are. Okay, if I step into the first slide of this presentation, that's our prayer and what we think is serious about the stuff that we do. And we are still committed to try and change those votes as an audit office as we think about the strategic plan as we go forward. We shared with the committee right at the beginning, I think it was last year, when we submitted strategy plan, which is now first year running. Because when former AG finished his work, the strategy plan that we had been pursuing had been up to the end of 2015. In fact, the discussion we just had now concludes finally in terms of the annual report. All those sentiments that were presented in 2006 by former AG. So that's closing that chapter, as it were, in terms of the strategic plan. What we have and what we're going to be presenting today is already work in progress. The current strategic plan that commenced on 1 April 2015, the current year that we're in, is the first year that we are on this Vision 2024 roadmap that we have developed as an audit office. So what we're sharing today is the strategy plan that we have proposed, or we are proposing, to take effect from 1 April 2016, because this current year is already in progress, and that strategy plan had already been shared with the committee. As an outline of the presentation, I'm just gonna kick off the first part, and I'm gonna hand over to the Deputy AG to share some detail in respect of some of the considerations for measuring how we're going to assess whether we are making progress, whether we are successful or otherwise. So if I go straight into the strategic roadmap, what we set up to do in this strategic plan, members, when we looked at 2015 going into 2024, we said, how do we want to be perceived, or how do we want to see whether we are making progress as an audit institution in the areas that our mandate requires of us. And we set out this and said, if as we stand here, we are looking at the work we have done and we are in 2024, what is it that we think must characterize the success that would have been achieved by the audit office? And one of the things we identified was that we want to be part of an institution that has contributed to the development of strong oversight and accountability in the area of the management of public funds. We also said we would like to also be associated with an institution that has got and has contributed to strong financial and performance management systems in government, as well as making a contribution towards a commitment to ethics by all that are handling public funds. In doing this, we felt that nothing can substitute for a competent and value-adding auditor general office. Therefore, we also are making a commitment and strategic plan to continue to elevate the level of competence and the level of professionalism among our people as a specific matter. We identified, Chair, a couple of areas that we believe will be defining how we make our contribution towards those goals that we have elevated there. And these key areas are the area of value add. We have positioned our audit intervention both as a regulatory audit or as a performance audit intervention, or any one of the areas of auditing, including information systems audit. We've positioned our intervention from a value-adding point of view to say that we'd rather pay attention to the areas that we believe will add more value in addition to signing just financial statements. And when we identified this, we looked at what are the critical areas where the bulk of expenditures go. Areas of health, infrastructure spend, education, all of those are specific programs that we often look at as part of saying how can we contribute through the eye of an auditor to the development of strong and effective systems of internal control that ensure that they can safeguard the public purse in any area where those expenditures are happening. The second bar is to look at our role as an institution to say that it's not enough to put audit recommendations and findings on the table and walk away from them. So we have elevated the need for visibility. It must be visibility for impact, which means that the interactions on a regular basis between accounting officers, between people in key financial officer positions and any other positions of governance. The key driver from our side is about how can we make an impact to contribute towards enhancing the capacity to act by those people who are charged with oversight, and to provide them sufficient information that they need to be able to act on areas where there are infractions as well as financial management deficiencies. The third component of these pillars is the viability. The viability looking at, from our perspective, the tools of trade that the audit office requires from time to time. The importance and the centrality of the independence of the office. The access to people that the office needs at all times, as well as the access to the financial resources that it will need to be able to convert our audit mandate into real programs that enhance public financial management. All of that, if it is to be done with a level of rigor expected of us, we also are committing to transforming our organization and committing to the vision and the values that we have identified, among which are what the Chair has referred to in respect of what we have observed in the Gauteng office. It is matters like those where we constantly appraise and engage our organization to ensure that what we do is always in the context of our overall vision and values as an audit office. So those are the key pillars, Chair, that our strategic plan that we are going to be sharing with you, the one that will commence on 1 April, will be based on. Fundamentally, those are the things that the whole of the organization has committed to. At the beginning, when I assumed the responsibility for this beginning of last year, we undertook a trip to engage all of the staff members in the office with a view to getting their sense of where we headed. But also we also had a survey that was done recently where we also got feedback externally from various external stakeholders to also assess how we are perceived as we go forward in this journey. What I can say, Chair, is that that feedback, after it was processed, including the internal feedback from the organization, including our own assessments in terms of the regular interactions, has been factored in strengthening this strategic plan that we are presenting. So what we have, which the Deputy AG is going to take us through then, will be strategy plan that is driven largely by these key elements, and and I thought that before I give to the deputy AG, I wanted to read something, Chair, which I just picked up from a paper that was written by the president of the Bundesrechnungshof, the audit office of Germany. They call it the Bundesrechnungshof. And this is a paper that was delivered talking about Supreme Audit Institutions. And maybe I'll just let Dr. Dieter Enders, who's the president of the Audit Office of Germany, have this to say, which I thought I can share as part of our further elaboration on this. He says that the Supreme Audit Institutions provide assurance as to whether the executive branch complies with the rules and responsibilities and highlight infringements of the rules. The Supreme Audit Institutions thereby contribute to strengthening accountability and improving government operations. By acting transparently and credibly, the Supreme Audit Institutions can further enhance the value of their contribution. Institutional and financial independence of the Supreme Audit Institution is an indispensable prerequisite for enabling them to successfully perform their audit function, unquote. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm now going to hand over to the Deputy AG to give us through the rest of the detail of the storage plan. Thank you.
Thank you, AG. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, everybody who's here. Go ahead. In thinking about the things that we've got to prioritize for the forthcoming year, we took into account not just the feedback that comes from the external stakeholders, but also our experience as we've been completing our more recent audit, which is really characterized by a much more rigorous engagement by those that actually run government. So the auditees and the leadership and the auditees are taking an even more active interest in audit outcomes, and they engage us in a much more rigorous way. We've also taken into account the notion that indeed our economy is one where there is no growth, and as we all know, there's no growth, there's no revenue increases, and therefore there is significant pressure on the ability of government entities to spend. And of course, not just the affordability issues in terms of our fees, but just even the ability to pay, which then brings us into the conversation we were having earlier on, led by the AG, on the challenges we have in accessing the cash associated with the work that we do. We also took into account the fact that the work that we do requires professional skills that are still in significant shortage right across South Africa. So we compete with the private sector, with the public sector, for professionals that must help us in doing the work that we are charged with doing. So we've got to continue to not only invest in a pipeline that is for our benefit, but also for the breadth of the accounting profession. So those are some of the considerations that we've taken into account in compiling this plan. Within the Act, there are a number of priorities. Principally, it's really about understanding and striving to meet our stakeholder expectations, to deepen the knowledge of the business of our auditees, predominantly through really understanding the breadth of the value chains, the work that they do, so that we can position ourselves to give value-adding recommendations, to give insights that help those charged with running government to do so even better. To structure our audit work and deliver audit messages that indeed help those that must run government, but also help key stakeholders understand, with transparency what's happening within the management of public purse. Another key objective is that we want to maintain very high standards of quality in the work that we do. And I think if you just look at the measures, so the focus initially is on action that must follow the external stakeholder survey that the AG spoke about. We then also are indeed, as I said, focusing on the value chain analyses, streamlining the processes that that we run internally towards delivering audit messages so that we are able to deliver quality messages but to do so efficiently and indeed effectively and with economy in terms of how our own environment operates. I think then, just go ahead. The next one is about, go ahead, the next one again. On the quality of the audits that we prepare. This aspect of our work is something that is of paramount importance, and we continue to aspire to attain an 85% to 90% quality in terms of the audit files that are reviewed from a quality control point of view every single year. And it's something that we continue to focus on, because indeed if we have an audit process failure in the work that we do, a confidence that key stakeholders will have in the work of the AG will diminish, and that would tarnish our reputation quite significantly. In our last conversation, Chair, there were some questions about how do we run our quality control processes within the organization. So we shared a slide that depicts how that runs. At the beginning of an audit cycle, whether it's PFMA or MFMA, we provide the auditors that sit at the different audit business units right across the country with technical guidance that helps them perform their audits with quality and consistency so throughout the system. Once they complete their audits, there are some audits that are required to go through a pre-issuance exercise, which is really assurance that helps the audit team ensure that there is quality in their files. So that would be just at the time of concluding an audit, and that happens for a large number of audits. When the cycle ends, we then have a team that operates within the office of the AG that reviews a selected number of files, and they put them through a detailed review and compare them to international auditing standards that we subscribe to and ensure that the audit file meets those requirements. And hopefully many files pass and hence the 85% target as a minimum. We then also voluntarily subject our audit files that have been QC reviewed to the Independent Regulatory Board auditors for them to have another look at our system of quality control, which helps us stay at the top of our game in terms of how we manage the quality of audit work throughout the office. We have a quality control assessment committee, which is chaired by the AG. It also includes members from external stakeholders, academics, and audit practitioners, who also sit with the AG and go through some of the files and look at the outcomes of the work that the quality control business unit has conducted. That gives extra assurance to us in terms of whether the scoring is appropriate for individual auditors, but also for the organization as well. It also helps us identify key areas that require corrective action throughout the system, so we can continue to improve how we run our audits. So our question, Chair, at the last meeting about how our targets stack up against the auditing profession, but also against other Supreme Audit institutions. Many audit institutions, the Supreme Audit institutions across the world don't publish their targets, so that was very difficult to arrive at. However, we continue to pursue our intended approach of running a formal benchmarking exercise to see how we can enhance our own quality control processes internally. What was of interest, though, is we did look at some of the statistics coming out of the regulator for auditing professions in different parts of the world. And the files that fail as a percentage in Canada is 18%, in the UK 33%, in South Africa is 43%. And of course, that, you know, we must caution that 43% is really one that is calculated on the back of high-risk audits that are selected by the regulator for quality reviews. So, it's biased towards a higher failure rate. But it gives you a feel for just how high we are targeting our quality scores. And we commit to sustain that. Within the goal of driving visibility for impact, we have two key objectives. One is, as I said, the visibility for impact, but also engaging citizens so that we effectively reach out to them and they're able to understand our work. In terms of the external stakeholder engagements, we're focusing in driving this vision of impactful engagements that the AG has set forth to provide our people with the tools and the methodologies that formalize how they can do this and do so with effect right across the country. It's really building on the journey of visibility that our office has already started on. We're also wanting to ensure that we drive the attitude and approach of partnering with our auditees, using tools and conversations that are structured in a supportive way to help especially accounting officers understand the key actions that they ought to take and keep them on track throughout the process. And in terms of these high quality stakeholder interactions, we're wanting to assess that at least a 70 to 75% satisfaction level. Then in terms of the we're also working on a sports leadership program that we're wanting to help not just accounting officers, the CFOs, understand what's happening in the space and inform them, give them useful insight, but also other external stakeholders, so that not only they get to understand our work, but they get value, they derive value out of the work that we conduct. Really using the benefit of a supreme audit institution that has access to the breadth of government, to then use that information and distill it so that players in the system, whether they are in the executive, in administration, or even in oversight, are able to have information that is of value to them. In terms of citizen engagement, I think you can move again. The focus is really on using different platforms to engage with citizens, to educate them more about the work of the Auditor General, to reach out to them, simplify our messages, communicate more regularly in a way that's digestible. So it's simple and digestible and allows people to understand exactly what we do and what the outcomes of that work actually is. I'll move on to viability, which as Angie indicated, is really about us ensuring that we have all of the resources that we require to execute our work with excellence and sustainability. So it's the people that we require, the type of skills we require, the financial resources, the technologies that help us be operationally efficient, not just in conducting audit, but also in terms of how our support services operate. Internal communications becomes then paramount to ensuring that we have employees that are critically engaged and consistently engaged in the work that we perform, and to make sure that in all the things that we do, we are informed by an outlook that is about sustainable operations. In terms of the finances, we continue to strive for a surplus that's in the region of 1 to 2%, and that becomes then the mechanism for us to sustain our operations for the long term. Debt collection is an area that requires continued focus, as we indicated earlier on in the conversation. We set very high targets in terms of collections that must be generated both at the national level and provincial levels. And the provincial BUs include the municipalities. Now, knowing what's happening in the environment, we are well aware, acutely aware, that these targets are particularly challenging. However, we're learning and seeing that if we don't set these high targets, the focus simply is can easily shift, and we really can ill afford an eye that shifts at any point in time. It's something that we have to continue to drive, and hence those very high targets. We're looking to focus on ensuring that we are efficient at all times in terms of our own internal operations, to maximize the value of the 1 million rand that we are generating at the top of the income statement, and ensure that we get the very best value out of it right across the organization. In terms of the people and the internal competencies, the focus here is really on implementing our people strategy, which looks at the entire value chain of human capital management. Our focus and our particular targets for the next year are really about the reward and recognition program, which we want to enhance because it must reflect the priorities for this particular strategic plan, and also implementing the competency framework and curriculum, which we've re-looked at over the past year, so that we develop over time the capacity and capability for all of our staff to deliver on this value add and visibility for impact goals that the AG has set. We also want to continue to maximize opportunities for our staff to benefit out of work done in what are still the Section 43 audits, which are the audits that are predominantly the state-owned companies. So over the past couple of years, you would have seen us take over the audit of the post office, the audit of the airport company, and those give the professionals in our environment exposure that is different from auditing a municipality and a department. And it enriches them as professionals and sharpens the tools for us as well. So we think that the audit portfolio benefits in terms of how the insights we're able to offer to the executive and to oversight, but also our people benefit just from having that experience. Also within the realm of looking at our operational efficiencies, the investments in technology have been lagging, as the AG indicated earlier on, and that's an area that is receiving significant attention, as you would have seen when we talked about the spend that we're making through the application of the service. So this particular area is really seeing a focus on driving efficiencies and using technology much better, not only in the internal environment, but also in terms of how we audit. So we're looking to revamp our audit software, which has been in use for several years now and is timely for us to look at it again. And we're making significant progress in that regard. And all of this is really about saying, how can we be more efficient and effective in the work that we do? How can we make sure that all 3,500 of our people benefit from the type of technology that does make their work a lot easier? Increasing internal visibility, this is consistent with some of the feedback we got from our staff as the AG and I went around the different business units talking to IG, but also when we got the stakeholder survey. Some of the feedback indicated that we need to communicate even more regularly and even more effectively and even more visible than what we have been within our internal environment. And here is a commitment to continue to do so. And it's critical that we do because as we drive these changes, the ability to engage our staff and keep them focused not just on driving a quality audit, but focused on being open to themselves, changing and doing things slightly differently so we can realize these ambitions. Central to that is going to keep them engaged and communicating and being visible to them as well. Embedding the concept of sustainability is really our saying the sensitivity about what the impact of our operations is on the environment is something that we have to continue to think about and keep it top of mind. Yes, it might not be a huge carbon emission type organization, but there are always opportunities for us to be much more thoughtful in how we run our operations in protection of the environment. So that's something that we are focusing on as well. Within the vision and values, as the AG indicated, there's a focus on driving ethical conduct. There's also a focus on continuing to lead by example, by driving also our own clean administration. We also, in this particular goal, look at transformation as well, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Let's start with transformation. We have a transformation strategy, and it's one that we think positions us well to continue to achieve the level 2 BBBE rating, even in the midst of more challenging targets arising from the amended Act and the amended Code. It is a challenging target, but it's one that we are committed to and it's one that we want to continue to strive for. And the focus areas are going to be not just on enterprise development, but on all elements of the scorecard. If we just go to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about that. With the management control, that's something that we don't struggle with, that the leadership and the management control and various levels of management is permeating between members for us are not a challenge. We seem to have got there. And that's really the benefit of the focus that the former AG and the current AG have had over a number of years. So we do benefit significantly out of that. It's an area we obviously can't be complacent about. It requires continued attention, but it's not a major challenge. With the skills development, our focus is on saying, yes, let's drive the pipeline for our benefit. Let's make sure we have the people that we need to do our work, but also let's make sure we continue to contribute to the transformation and growth of the accountancy profession in this field. So herein is a check about offering bursary to people, offering support to universities, and then still driving the training contracts and the different learning and development interventions internally. With the Enterprise Development Program, which we piloted over the past year and want to continue to expand on that, which is really about finding ways to support the development of smaller black practices so that not only do they over time become key players in our contract work allocation program, but they are able to then stand on their own feet and genuinely be meaningful players in the broader accountancy profession as sustainable businesses. And then from a socioeconomic development point of view, we want to continue to enhance our corporate social investment program, which is quite far-reaching, as you know. Within clean administration, the AG likes to say this is our license to operate. as a bit of sort of a non-negotiable. So our focus on ensuring that our risk management processes, our internal controls, remain firmly intact is something that we don't take our eye off at all. We continue to ensure that we have appropriate policies that are applied and monitored consistently. We attend to closing the audit findings when they come from internal or external audits every single year. And those are the key priorities for the year 16-17. And as I indicated, they're really building on what the current plan is that we're operating on. Now move on to the budget. Okay. I think if we just go to the numbers. The budget is built along the funding principles that inform the funding model of this organization. And really they are about keeping our eye on the split between our own hours, the work that we do ourselves directly using our own staff, as well as what we outsource in terms of the contract work allocation, and keeping that at a maximum of 22%. And we do that because it helps us, the supplementing capacity is important for us, but we can't have it too big a number because we don't get any margin out of the work that we allocate out. So the gross margin that we allocate out, we basically forego. So we want to make sure that we keep the balance intact. To have a gross profit percentage, that's at least 32%. And to maintain our overheads at a reasonable rate of 30% and to drive a surplus of 1-4%. If I move on to the middle of the slide, on the middle of the thin slide, the audit hours that we are tracking for or budgeting for the year 16-17 are increasing because we're going to be doing even more work ourselves and continue to take a little bit more out of the contract work allocation base and reduce that to 21%. And hence we'll see an increase of to 2.3 billion that we will do of what we will do ourselves. The work that we will contract out is at 657 million and there are the S&Ts that we will recover associated with the work that we do ourselves. In terms of the ratios that we're anticipating for 16-17, the contract work allocation will decrease to 21%. The gross profit will retain at 32%. However, our overhead will increase slightly. And that's largely because we anticipate that we'll start to bring down the tariff all the time. The actual cost to the audit portfolio will actually start to decrease. And we are retaining a surplus of only 1%. That being the impact of wanting to reduce the actual cost of audit at the very top line. If I go to the cost of audit in terms of what we cost the fiscus effectively, over time, the Office of AG has had increases of 7% in 2014-15, 11% this year, 15-16. However, we're targeting an increase of 5%. The increases over the past couple of years have been informed, yes, by inflation, especially payroll inflation, but also by the number of audits, newer audits that we've been taking on board. Some of those would include the South African Post Office, the ACRA, a number of ACT colleges that we've taken over. We've had some take back on some of the different audits from private firms. However, our target for the year going forward is to maintain an increase of only 5%. And that should be taking into account the affordability challenges in the environment. The difference between what we know will be a payroll inflation line, which is going to drive under 5%, we will absorb using the audit efficiencies that we will drive, which they spoke about earlier on, and also through making sure that we continue to reduce even our own costs within the operations of the Office of the AG. So the big headline number there is the 5% increase instead of what we know will be a much higher increase from an inflation point of view, and will drive efficiency so that we can continue to pay competitive salaries for the professionals that are in our environment. We currently have more than 500 chartered accountants that work for the Office of the AG. And the very last thing we want to do is to compromise the journey that we've been on, professionalizing the office, and to lose the stability in the audit space. Right. One of the key sources of inefficiency in the audit processes, which drive audit costs, is this issue of the quality of financials that are submitted for audit at the initial instance. And this is a matter that we've reported on over the last few years, that when we arrive to audit in the first instance, we're given a set of financials. We then audit it, we find errors, and then the auditee is then given an opportunity to fix those errors. Then we come back and audit it again before we can finally conclude. And sometimes this happens two or three times before the audit is concluded. Now, the benefit of this is that the number of auditees that are able to achieve unqualified financial statements has been increasing. But the downside of this is that this practice is costly, because it takes a lot of time when we have to give back the financials, they're fixed, we audit again and again. So it increases the cost of audit. And therefore, it's an unsustainable practice. What it indicates, indeed, is that internal controls environments in many of the auditees have not stabilized to an extent where they're able to, on their own, submit financials that are of a good quality. And it's one of the areas that does increase audit costs, and it's one of the areas that we're going to have to work with auditees to try and minimize, obviously without compromising audit outcomes. Okay, go ahead. One of the key considerations in coming up with our budget was that we do continue to see a major struggle in the collection of debtors, especially in the local government sphere, with key provinces of weakness being Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, and the Northwest. And we have done some work to give ourselves some comfort that if we continue to push on the collections, we should be able to still close the year with a decent cash balance, even at the 5% audit fee increase. It's quite slim, but it's something that we think we'll be able to achieve. I think that slide highlights that at the end of 2014-15, we had debtors in total of 700 million rand, of which 356 were local government debtors. On average, those were outstanding for a period of 292 days. In our income statement, included in some of the costs that we put through the income statement, is a provision every year for debtors that we think we will never collect. That number is about 6% of our audit income, which we basically write off the income statement, and it adds to the cost that we have to sustain in the organization. I think, go ahead. One of the areas that is a challenge in terms of collections for us relates to what we've called local 1% debtors. The Public Audit Act provides that if the audit fee of an auditee exceeds 1% of the total current and capital expenditure, the excess in 1% will then be paid by the National Treasury if the National Treasury is satisfied that there is a financial difficulty to settle within that auditee. And every year we do a calculation that says how many 1%ers do we have based on the criteria of audit fee relative to total current and capital expenditure, what audit fee have they paid, and what is the excess. And so the top line there, the 87.4 million right up to the 120.68 million, those are the numbers we calculate every year for these 1% debtors. The amount that we've been paid by the National Treasury is the second line, which shows 30 million up to 41.86 million. So the gap between this 120 and the 41 million would then sit as part of the debtors balance for the AGSA, and the SPASU continues to remain uncollected. So some of the proposals that the AG spoke about really looks at dealing with this issue in terms of how do we work better between ourselves and National Treasury to minimize the cost of audits, but also to minimize the gap between what we're supposed to be paid in terms of the Public Audit Act and what we do receive in terms of what the National Treasury has budgeted and is able to pay. And I think that's a bit tricky. The proposals, I think, you saw here, yeah.
Thanks very much, David. There's one bit which we not have here, but it's out of the work that we do, which would have been elaborated on in the strategy plan, is our involvement beyond the South African borders, our international work. Currently, we do not have any assigned audits that have been allocated to us by any of the international agencies we use to audit. However, we do have a footprint within the community of auditors general in the work that we do. Currently, there's the capacity building committee, the chair of that international body, South Africa, is assuming that responsibility. So there's a lot of work of that nature that we do internationally, and it's starting to also move beyond the confines of auditors general, because there are also other relationships with large international development organizations, especially when there are matters like your sustainable development goals that international institutions are required to look at, especially with auditors general as well. So there's that part of the work, so that when we talk our international role, it's largely in that area, in the pursuit of the overall inter-site agenda. So I thought that's one part of the mix that I could add to this. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, AJ. That went faster than we thought. Let's engage members. Just remember that ultimately we're going to either approve or disapprove the strat plan and budget. So that's really what it's about. So ours is to engage with the AG, and sometime behind closed doors, or not behind closed doors, but outside of the AG and his team, we will then have to either approve or disapprove. So you have an opportunity now to interact with the presenters of this strat plan. Any takers or you speaking about it? Mr. Singh?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. There's one thing that we noticed, that there's a general improvement in audit outcomes. I mean, we noticed that across departments and entities as well. But I think the big concern still is that the basics are not done, because that is the cause for the kind of outcome in many of the entities and provincial departments. To what extent is your office actively engaging with National Treasury in respect of the government departments to ensure that they have programs, because it's their responsibility, as you said earlier on, it's unsustainable internally. To what extent are you engaging with them, and how often do you engage with them to ensure that they preach the gospel to all their departments that, guys, you've got to get the basics right, and what kind of, you know, education do they have in that regard? Because if they don't do that, which is their primary responsibility, then you are going to have the difficulty of auditing, re-auditing, telling them that the financial statements are not right, etc., etc. So that's something, and I'm asking a chairperson vis-a-vis your strat plan and whether that's been focused there. Then a general question is that when do you think, AG, South Africa is going to be ready, or most of the departments are going to be ready, where we don't have to look at financial audits, but we start looking at performance audits? Because I think that is our major concern moving forward. Other countries in the world, well, okay, developed countries like New Zealand, financial audits is a thing of the past, dead and buried. Every department or every client of theirs is up to mark on the financial audit, but perform, because that's what we have to move towards. Because the people in our country want service delivery. Then the next question, Chair, is you've done your stakeholder survey. 2015. But to what extent has the outcome of that survey influenced your SAC plan? Because I see you want to do it every 3 years. Now, shouldn't it be done more often or at a time when it actually influences your SAC plan moving forward? Checking as you proceed, two more questions. Your contract work, the consultants, I know there's a decrease in terms of how much you use, which is a good sign. But if you start bringing down the tariffs that you charge your clients, how will it impact on you getting these outside consultants doing work for the office of the AG? And then, Chairperson, your audit income, if I look at it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is about 3 billion baht. 3 billion. Have you ever stopped to think what impact your audits are having in terms of savings within departments and that kind of thing? You know, a cost-to-benefit ratio has that been done? And lastly, the National Treasury, I know, Chair, and I think this is for us, has not paid this amount of 41.86 million on this 1% principle that they have. Maybe we need to do something about it, you know, after the Office of the AG does a presentation to us. And very last, which is a general concern, is sometimes one feels that the work of the auditor is a tick-the-box exercise. You can't do more than, you know, looking at financials and things like that. Because we find that some entities and some government departments get one unqualified audit with emphasis of matter. But then a week or 2 weeks later, some whistleblower comes along. It happened with one of the CETAs and informs you that there's been a lot of corruption there. So now how does one weigh what the auditor does vis-a-vis what emerges sometimes in some of these departments? Sorry, Chair, I have so many questions, but thank you very much.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you, Chief. I don't know if I should refer to the pages, okay, but on page 6 we were talking about the competition of skilled labour. And although we picked it up in some of the departments, especially in our committees, especially when it comes to engineering and that type of thing, that you find that government departments or departments within government actually becomes the biggest competition with taking skilled workers from other departments, is what is the general having the same problem. Because it seems like, and just to give an example, you will, for example, have a department of transport having an engineer that is getting 700,000 rand a year, but you will get a municipality coming in and offering that engineer a salary of 1.1 million. So competition within government. I'll skip that one because Mr. Singh touched on that slightly. Okay, then notwithstanding the cost factor, why do we go back, and I know this was also mentioned, but why do we go back 2 to 3 times to tell them to fix internal controls on audit? Surely if we're going to keep on doing that, we're just defeating the whole purpose of audit. I think we've been covered before we even started the session, just that we think that we should have an age analysis and an amount by entity to assist and also to see what we can do from the committee side. The allegations from National Treasury. Okay, now I'm not very clever when it comes to the figures, but if you can just, if we look at the audit here, we look at 2013-2014, we look at the approved and paid amount by National Treasury, it went down to 55%, although it's not cash in the bank yet, but just what would be the reasons why it decreased? I think that would cover me for now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, dear person. Not too much from my side. Also on slide 6, just the last bullet point there, increased competition with skilled labour and insufficient quality of school education. This is a problem that we find right across government departments, is that the pool of available resources isn't really sufficient for the needs of the departments themselves, and it's often what we blame for the lack of performance in departments. Is there any action from the part of the AG to
get information down into higher education and even basic education as to salary possibilities within AG's office. Are we trying to address that issue by any interaction between yourselves and those departments to say, guys, this is what our future projected needs are. Can you start working towards that by raising up children and so on too? So when we get to that stage, we need to have the available resources. And if I can just refer you to slide number 12, which is a point of interest because I say there you say, just trying to find the slide, sorry. No quality control targets are specified by the SAIs, and in relation to the SAIs, our level of quality is very high. Now, presumably you conduct some kind of comparative arrangement with other countries and what their Supreme Court institutions do. But do you do it on the same basis? Are you both, are you measuring apples to apples? Or do they have the same set of parameters that they're looking at in order to determine their quality, and we're looking at the same things? Or how else will we arrive at this kind of conclusion? As you just give me a little bit of info, just for interest's sake, I was interested to know how you were able to make those statements in here. What informs that? And then the same slide that my colleague referred to from the National Treasury inputs, if you could just, maybe I'm being very simplistic here, but the first sort of thought that comes into my mind is, if you're coming to this committee year after year, so maybe you retain your surplus, but then National Treasury still has to fund you as well, just fill me in on this. Am I missing something? Why do you need money from National Treasury if you've got a surplus that you're asking us that you can retain as well? Do you need funding from both? Maybe I missed some aspect of it, if there was some other sort of element to this whole scenario, but I would just like to know, just to explain to me the rationale there, if you wouldn't mind, please. Thank you.
No? Ms. Bennett?
Thank you, Chair. My question is around the issue of whether the AG has any instruments to enforce the auditors to comply with the legislation and to hold them accountable, even on the issue of the use of consultants and the instability in key positions by the various departments, because these are the root causes of the auditing being delayed and the issue of disclaimers and not clean auditing in with regards to the departments. These are always been findings of the auditor general in the departments, whether do they have any instrument with regards to the enforcement for them to make sure that every department has clean audit. Thank you.
I'm so sorry, I was flipping pages, but I forgot to look at the back what I wrote. This is just a quick question. And last year, with the meeting with the Audit General, as well as in the workshop we had last year, we asked if there was a possibility that we can be provided with a sort of findings register. And that findings register would also have a root causes with your just sort of 5 W's or 4 W's to try and, you know, if that was available, that reoccurring problems could actually be solved without it being reoccurring. Do you have any plans in place that will be made available to this committee as well as all the departments?
Let me add my 2 cents. There's a lot, but at least when you get to them, I suppose we just follow up and we'll probably be done. First, AG, just a general comment, and if it's going to compromise you, then I'll understand if you don't. You know, we, in committee and in Scopus specifically, the value add of internal audit and audit committees leaves a lot to be desired. And in my experience, it's not necessarily because those departments don't have capacity, but it's because of the cooperation of CFOs and account officers. Just disregard those people. Leave us a comment on that if you want. What is your finding on that? Because that's what we pick up in certainly when we're working so far. The second one was, and you indicated that part of your quality control is done externally by the Independent Regulatory Board. Are you able to give us their latest assessment? I mean, we're taking your word for it now that they're saying that you're doing well, but I would imagine that after they've done an assessment, they would give you some sort of a written report. If you could just give that to us. We're not doubting your word, but it would satisfy us if we also have for our own records that the independent body is concurring with you that your standards are acceptable. I think Ms. Carter touched on this one. I was not aware of Ms. Carter. Maybe you spoke about a workshop, and I'm not sure AD was this. It was just a once-off. But I really think that what would be missing in your stack plan, if it's not a permanent something, you speak about value add and assisting accountability and governance. Would it be asking too much if we said to you that on an annual basis you need to do some sort of a workshop with all MPs in terms of the importance of the information you give and how they can use it? Now, I'm not sure that, if I'm understanding Ms. Carter, it seems to have been done at one point. Maybe that was when members first came. I don't think that's sufficient. The reality is that outside of the people here and in SOPA, nobody, in fact, they're intimidated by the financials. So is it a feasible idea to say that once a year we have all MPs in the room and have this type of a discussion where they understand the importance and what they can do with the information that they give you? Is it, I'm saying it's not in your strat plan, but is it a feasible idea? And if it is, maybe Mr. Singh and Ms. Carter, we should be using that as part of the agenda for training. I don't understand why they train me every year how to log on to onto internet. Every year they teach me how to log on to internet. But nobody teaches me these type of things. I'm talking about in our inductions every year. So for me, we need to change the agenda. And one of those that we could suggest is training on dealing with audit reports. The next one is, I think it's your slide 20 and maybe also your slide 22. You talk about an occupancy rate of 89 to 91%. Am I understanding that to be meaning that you'll have a 9% vacancy rate? Because we fight with departments who have 3%, I think, or 5% vacancy rate. Why should we allow you a 9% vacancy rate, if I'm reading that slide correctly? Ms. Carter, and I think Mr. Singh touched on this one, and again, we're just asking for your opinion, because maybe we'll need to deal with it. I agree with Ms. Carter and Mr. Singh that the affording departments opportunity to correct. In other words, if you went in the first time, as it's done in the corporate world, many departments will be found wanting in terms of qualifications. You go back, and it might be a good thing. But if going back means that there is additional cost to the AG, why is the going back not tied up to a penalty? If we come back after the second time, then there's going to be a penalty attached. Because I think there has to be a carrot and stick approach. It seems like you go back and you don't charge them for going back. I'm saying, would it be a train smash if the condition of going back is a carrot and stick? Because I think this is what Mr. Singh is talking about. You're either going to have a qualified audit. If you want us to give you an opportunity to go and fix it up because it's minor stuff and get a clean audit, but it's going to cost you because initially you did the wrong thing. So is it feasible? And then the final point that I'm making, AG, am I reading it correctly that the debt collection problem, Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, and Northwest, I think you referred to, now that correlates with the bad audits that come out of there. I'm saying if we had to say to you, give us the worst performers in terms of audit outcomes, does that mirror the worst performers in terms of payments. You see, it could well be that, well, because we're getting a negative audit, we're not going to pay for it. So in other words, it's almost a blackmail exercise. You're giving me a negative audit opinion, therefore you struggle to get money out of me. And I'm saying to you, is that a correct reading? Because we will then have to do something on our side, or we'll have to make some sort of recommendation to Parliament if that is correct. That is the extent of my questions, and there's probably now about 20 questions that we have. Let's allow members, if there's any more knee-jerk questions that you picked up, then we allow them. Are we all covered? We will allow opportunity for follow-up if you're not very covered about what has come up. So in any order, I'll try and tick as you go along and remind you if you've missed out any. But over to you and your team, AG, on any of these matters, and we'll afford members a second bite if there's a need to.
Thank you. I don't want to make a commitment that we will happily finish this part of the meeting possibly by 11. We're not going to be too long on the answers. I think the answers, that the questions that have been raised are clear. First of all, the first question regarding the extent of engagement with National Treasury. We have that as a standard interaction on an ongoing basis, starting from the technical people meeting frequently to pick up issues that arise on our side as well as on the side of National Treasury, right up to ourselves, the National Treasury, as well as the Accounting Standards Board, which is the body set up in terms of the BFMA to process accounting standards. So compare notes, we have a regular engagement with National Treasury, let alone on a bilateral basis between ourselves and the office of the Accountant General. Because the starting point for us, whatever we are required to pronounce on when it comes to the audit, it ought to be based on the accounting framework that is prescribed by National Treasury through the Accountant General's office. So there's a regular interaction and engagement with them. In fact, one of the things also on our side that we think has become necessary and we have built into the strategy plan has been an additional effort on our part to build capabilities for us to be able to engage quarterly with the subject of key controls. And that subject of key controls is about saying, one of the things that we as auditors would often look at is the status of accounting records. And you can look at the status of accounting records prior to the commencement of the audit, because it's about what have you been doing for the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, insofar as producing a set of accounting records that can be relied upon for purposes of doing the audit. And there are various other things that are linked to the key engagements on a quarterly basis. And the idea for this that we have introduced this is to say, better that we are proactive about the identification of what these internal control deficiencies that are likely to trip the department or entity when it comes to reporting on their finances. What are they? So that we can elevate upfront, let them, as the leadership of the institution, process so that which needs to be done to fix that internal control. So we think that but as much as a lot of stuff gets picked up after the books are closed, when they are revealed in an audit, this will give an opportunity for an early intervention to be made. And I think if the portfolio committees are also aligned to that journey, we'll be able to communicate with them upfront to say, in that particular department, heads up, the area of supply chain management has not been properly handled to be able to substantially meet the audit requirements. It's a good time for you as a portfolio committee, for example, to intervene so that come the time of the audit, there's at least an opportunity that was given for it to be fixed. And it also is a way of saying this will also slow down the rate at which financial statements are resubmitted for audit, because a lot of those typical errors that are likely to cause an audit failure would have been engaged with upfront. So we are hoping that once we put this in place, we are busy doing as you said earlier, on some of the resources that we had from the surpluses was to start trying to build capacity for us to do something that will add to improving these outcomes. Because where it's leading to, it's leading to trying to address the question you raised, Honorable Slim, regarding once, and of course this is the next question that's following, once you've got all of these stabilized financial control environments and the rigor and transparency when it comes to financial reporting. And we've got a strong foundation from which to enhance the effort that we've already put in when it comes to performance audits. And I think the point I want to underline is that performance audits should not wait for the financial management disciplines to all be correct, because that will never happen. However, if there is some level of stability in making sure that there are people who have accountability and responsibility for explaining transactions that were carried out. Because if we bring an additional burden, because I think one looks at performance audit as a very attractive approach to dealing with issues of efficiency and effectiveness at a deeper level. But the bottom line is, when Minister of Finance announces the total bag of money to be sent, it's all just 1 point something trillion. Whether you assess its effective spend via a regularity audit or a performance audit or any other type of audit, the bottom line is still testing the same amount of rent. Now the difficulty is, if you then enhance the other side of auditing, which will be testing the same money but looking at different elements of it from a deeper qualitative analysis, you can still come with a conclusion, whatever the conclusion is. But the bottom line is that that conclusion of the performance audit will also require the same attention of the people who are supposed to attend to the deficiencies of the regularity audit, who are not doing it fast enough. So we don't want to run into a situation where we've committed too many resources trying to do different streams of auditing, but ultimately when all is said and done, we hit the same bottleneck. Same type of findings, and I can always share the example of when we speak about performance audits. We did a performance audit at the Northern Cape Mental Hospital some few years ago when we looked at the infrastructure delivery in health and education, all of those things that were done by public health on behalf of those departments. We did a performance audit. We've been doing a statutory audit every year. That project had been sitting on the ground incomplete for however many years. I think SCOBA has been there physically on a site visit, and all manner of other oversight have been on that place. And the question we asked ourselves is, after we spent that amount of resources on performance audit, we did come to conclusions. Regularity audits come to the same conclusions every year about all manner of things regarding wasteful expenditure, irregular expenditure, and all that. And the problem raising is, what value did that additional performance audit add? Because nothing has been changed as it were now. So we are also trying to be careful, because we know there are limited resources. We do want to perform extra and additional performance audits, but we are also saying to ourselves, is this a different audience that we're going to talk to when it comes to elevating the findings? It's effectively going to be the same audience. And the question is, the key test for this area of performance audit to also find resonance in terms of the speed with which it's implemented is also going to rely on the responsiveness of oversight. External stakeholder survey, as well as its influence over the strategy plan. We did the stakeholder survey with a view to picking up certain matters that we may not already have thought of. There are certain elements that would have been incorporated so that we don't forget about them over the next couple of years. However, as in any other situation, when we do significant levels of implementation of the plans that we have in place, we also don't want to go back on the survey mode frequently, because a lot of these interventions that we might put in place will take some time before they result in any real fruitful outcomes. So we will take time, because once we accelerate the implementation over 3 or so years, certainly it will make sense to look back after you've gone through that journey to see how things have been. I think the benefit of this external survey, for example, if one looks at it was undertaken at a time after there had been significant public engagements over the last 5 to 7 years on audit outcomes. And I think it was proper to undertake it now, because a lot of different stakeholders would have had some significant experience of what has come in the last 3 to 5 years around our work. And we think that we probably want to take the next round as well, implementing the type of things that we believe will make a difference, so that we can test them as we have undertaken the journey. Conduct work and the consultants, as well as the issue of reduction of tariffs. The tariffs that we pay out to private audit firms that work on our work are normally lower than ours. So I think we'll exercise some sensitivity when it comes to looking at that part of the work, because the argument has always been that the profession does our work at a time when they have low peaks, meaning that the work that we do, they do for us, is ready to fill the overhead gap on their side and stuff like that. So we do not intend going deeper into that tariff because it's already lower than our normal one, and I think we'll try and be more responsible not to squeeze them any further. We'll take a knock and the pay on our side by also committing to strengthening our own internal efficiencies. The audit revenue of 3 billion, what impact is this having on finances of the state? I think, honorable member, the benefits that come from a rigorous internal control environment are normally felt down the line, because I think the measurement will always be about what is our experience of the flow of resources as well as going to the places where they were intended. That's the one part. I think if we've got more transparency, we'll be able to see that, and I think that probably the intangible benefit, among others, that we can see. But I think the immediate benefit is the deterrent effect in a number of places. I mean, if one brings the option of someone who tries to nicely persuade auditors to say something different from what they saw, is also another factor which deters other people who may have been thinking that way. So it does help in making sure that the systematic reduction of possibility for people to have too many fingers on the till. To that extent, I think the audit does help, because without it, a lot of the things that we see, both in terms of a reduction of expenditure on consultants in quite a number of entities in the last 2 years, is evident enough of how some of these things, when they were put on the spotlight in the public domain about the use of consultants, how the behavior across the board has changed. We now see evidence in a number of places where people have it as the first option to interact with somebody else before they make a decision about engaging external service providers. It's not like that across the board, but there are gains that one can see. And I think it does help in providing additional improvements. If one looks at other jurisdictions, when the likes of your accrual accounting has been adopted fully and observed, a lot of other jurisdictions experience different qualities of information that they get from the people who are responsible for programs. Why? Because the rigor of an audit allows what information to be tested as well as to be made reliable in the eyes of the users of that information. So there are a lot of benefits that come with what is being spent in terms of this. Because I think the other question could be, what could potentially have gone the other way were it not for people knowing that there is going to be a rigorous engagement with what they've done. And the beauty about it is that there's also, even though people know that an audit is going to happen, an audit has got its own ways to find other things. I think from time to time we rely on the fact that that's a right element you cannot easily beat, even if you know how to hide things. Lack of auditors being seen as a tick-tock exercise, giving good outcomes and then subsequently experience negativity. So I think fundamentally, I think if one looks at an audit, certainly I think we all agree that there are certain inherent limitations in an audit. And we take it with that as well to say, we will give you this level of assurance about the rigor with which the financial statements have been provided. We will test certain things that we believe could potentially mislead the user of the financial statements. And there are certain things that we also cannot avoid. For example, even in an environment, there's some level of collusion between the people who make decisions and the ones who are custodians of assets and the ones who keep records and all of that. If there are levels of collusion that are deep enough in a particular environment, however smart an auditor, they probably will not pick that up. So there are certain inherent limitations, but I think the fact that we always have this internal control checking on all of these things, a lot of them do not survive forever. And I think that if one looks at a number of corporate scandals, whether you go to the likes of Enron or any one of those, some of those funny things they did started with things like the processing of journal entries. Journal entries is about creating a different message for the person who's going to use that information. But it could be trying to hide money that's already left the books by transferring a journal entry from one place to another. And a small thing like that, somebody could be thinking, but why are you worried about a journal entry? Because a journal entry is not money. It's like taking an A4 piece of paper and writing debit account issue and credit account that, just to try and move the transactions in the books. But nobody has an idea about how much is already gone and how much is likely to go as a result of that misleading journal entry that has been processed. So what we are saying here is that in order to prevent those things, the people that are charged with oversight and governance must not just look for the big supply chain management contract of 450 million rand and only chase that thing. We must also worry about the status of accounting records. Who's responsible for creating these accounting records? Who's responsible for supervising them? Does somebody understand this particular infrastructure delivery on the back of which this journal entry is being proposed? Because it might just be a book entry, but it might have significant implications in respect of misleading and providing that negative outcome. So, okay, if one looks at an example like this, if I live in a municipality and there's a domineering mayor in the municipality who also owns a fleet of taxis, if there's collusion in that case, is it possible that the service station down the road in that small town could be used as where the taxis fill up? But if there's enough collusion, nobody can stop the invoice from being sent to the creditors department of the municipality so that payments of those fueling of those fleet of taxis could be done in the municipality without anybody knowing. But at the end of the year, you could end up that municipality has been well run, having a unqualified with no findings audit because the total effect of those expenditure at the service station probably will not so material as to raise a flag in terms of financial statements, but the owner of the service station knows about it. The fact that there's a set of clean audit financial statements from that municipality is neither here nor there in the eyes of the owner of that service station, because they know they fill those vehicles that belong to the mayor, despite what the financial statements say. That reference of some of the limitations, I guess, as I conclude on that item. And competition for skills, government departments, they take from us. Yes, we encourage them to come and take, in fact. That's what we encourage them to do. They say, please come and take, because we've got SS people that finish their articles with us. Our economics and the design of our finances and how our finances operate will not allow us to retain every one of those people that started in 2012, finishing the articles this year. Many of them have broken out and work elsewhere. So you'll see a lot of our people joining our OTs. We think that the first prize is good for the whole of the public sector, because it means the resources that we were talking about earlier on, about providing training, capacity and skills in financial management and other disciplines, we are able to produce them ourselves, and therefore people can come and take or come and recruit for us. In fact, our staff, because they are exposed to some of these, whether it's metros or some of these departments, others are already holding those senior positions. However, we don't have any cooling off period, otherwise we'll be denying them opportunities for employment if we can't employ them ourselves. However, we do make sure that when they get that aside, they understand now that they are no longer an auditor. They are CFO, so that when we deal with them, they don't remind us about the things that they used to know while they were working with us, because we now have got a different conversation with them. They are sitting on the outside. We are evaluating them despite the fact that they used to evaluate themselves. So we do have many mechanisms to tackle that, but we do support the fact that in growing the skill base in the country, particularly in the public sector, we are principally one of those institutions that provide that capability. Why do we keep going back to fix internal controls? Otherwise, it might be defeating the purpose of the audit. I think the starting point for this, Honorable Carter, is that financial statements, largely, if one looks at the audit report and scrutinizes what it says that when we write it, and I mean, this is the standard that applies in all jurisdictions as well as the private sector, is that we draw attention to what these financial statements are to start with. You know, we'll say that we've audited the financial statements set out on page 1 to 11. These financial statements are the responsibility of management. That's the standard term that we use. These financial statements are the responsibility of management. And then go on and on and on about another blurb in terms of what we do when we audit and so on and so forth. And then say at the bottom, our responsibility is to express an opinion on these financial statements. So if these financial statements belong to management, for as long as management, for as long as we have not reached the cut-off date for signing off the audit report, management can do that which they want to do to those financial statements. However, the PFLA prescribes that if your year end is March, you've got to hand over those financial statements by the end of May, which means that between the beginning of April and the end of May, that 2 months is the 2 months where management can do whatever they want to those financial statements. But once they've submitted them to us at the end of May, they now are our financial statements for expressing the opinion we need to express on them. The minute we return those financial statements to management in the period between the 1st of July, of June, which is the day after the submission end of May, up to the end of July when we have to write a report on them, any time that they withdraw those financial statements are regarded by definition as withdrawn from submission. So when they withdraw them, that's the time that they are fixing these errors that we picked up as we are auditing. Then the point we are making is that for as long as they are keen to fix, because they are the ones who have to make a representation about the fair presentation, ours is to report on the fair presentation. So we can't deny them. We have to allow them to get to a point where they think this is fair presentation, and ours is to express our opinion on that. So we are in a flux. We've got a law that says they can't take them back, but we've got an auditing standard that says allow them to do it because it's their financial statements. It's not yours. Yours to express an opinion on them. And that's where the dynamic comes into the equation. So we highlight this matter then to respond to the requirements of the PFLA, which says let all of them give those financials to you by the end of May and tell us if anything has happened between the end of May and the end of July insofar as withdrawal is concerned. Because I guess the people who put that clause in, they wanted to know whether people have not been doing their work throughout and start trying to fiddle around now while the auditors are here. So it is to that extent that our hands are tied. We can't not allow them. The allocations from National Treasury, what the allocations have decreased to 35% in 2011, and leave that to the DHHS to fill the gap later on. A work done by AG with regard to schools as well as looking at the future projected needs. The extent to which we get involved with schools is largely in our nurturing program, where we explain and expose students across different schools in the country, particularly in rural areas, about what this thing called the audit office is about and how do you, as a young person growing up in a school environment, could potentially relate to what we do. And we also invite them and give them access to quite a lot of documented material that they sometimes use, and some of them find it helpful. We haven't really taken that engagement to levels deeper, whereby we start asking the schools whether they are producing people that look like what we might need. We haven't really got to that level, but ours has really just been limited to providing support and exposure insofar as career options as well as the essence of the institution. The corrections to other jurisdictions as well as issues of there's work that we are doing in this area, Chair, which is starting to kick off. That's about the peer reviews, basically, where one supreme audit institution or two partner to go and review certain elements of a particular audit office. They look at issues of quality, they look at issues of time reporting, because in some jurisdictions, what we have here, where we are able, on the day the financial statements are finished, we've got 2 months to get them, and we succeed to the extent of about 96-97% in terms of the submission, and we are able within 3 months to table the report. It's a fantastic turnaround time in terms of the reporting cycle and enhancing accountability. In other jurisdictions, the report does not even surface in certain instances. So you've got a report pertaining to this year, 2014-2015, which will never be seen for another 2 or 3 years or so. So we've got those kind of situations in other places where the independence of the institution is not so protected as to provide space for the institution to willingly and at any time issue the report. So these comparisons we normally do when we do peer review work, because peer review work, we look at issues of quality, we look at issues of substance, we look at issues of responsiveness and engagement with stakeholders and other related matters. Right, the money from National Treasury and why we need this when we're talking surpluses. There's a history behind this, Chair, and it was linked to looking at the trouble that was anticipated perhaps right at the beginning when most of these municipalities were amalgamated. It was clear that some of them are in sub economic environments where it will be permanently difficult for that municipality to generate income its own. Municipality relies on injections that come from the center as an allocation in order to boost work. However, because of the history of these amalgamated municipalities, especially the low-capacity ones, who had no real base with regards to people that they employed who are able to do this work, and so auditors had to assume quite a deeper level of responsibility to try and upgrade and help in the reporting process. So National Treasury then way back committed that they will step in for a portion of what is due as the audit fee. So it's not a direct funding by National Treasury. It's really just to say, these guys that you looked at are our siblings, if you like, and therefore we will step in for them when they're in trouble because we understand their economic situation. So that's really the essence of it. It's that type of injection. It's almost like a recovery from somebody else for money which was due by another. It's not like a direct allocation that National Treasury has to pay. So when we get to the stage of the determination of the surplus or otherwise, that particular expectation in terms of the contribution, the revenue by National Treasury will always be part of that equation. Instruments at the disposal of the AG to enforce compliance. As far as this one is concerned, we unfortunately have not been given too many instruments to be able to enforce compliance on a number of the things that we do. But we always try to evade the side of gentle persuasion in most instances, so that we look at this also as an institution building exercise in certain ways. To say that it's probably not going to help that we do not have much enforcement capability. However, if we are able to use our professional judgment to persuade people to embrace the need for these financial disciplines to be put in place, because it helps with quite a lot of things. It helps with having to account for how the work that's claimed to be done has been done, and it also helps to get many people out of trouble for stuff that could have been resolved. So the thing that we, from our side at least, why we appreciate the fact that the enforcement for compliance may see elsewhere, we at least do our bit to try and show what's good about embracing the type of disciplines that we espouse. Finding register and root cause analysis, we have an issue in our general report, Chair and Honourable Members, where we have summarized as best we can. We have been putting it in that general report, an issue. And an issue in the general report, whether it's for local government or whether it's for the PFA, only sits at the back of our general report. I think it's an issue A, if I remember. It's kind of a findings register. It's got every single one of those 468 ODTs that we are commenting on in terms of these outcomes, and it will have every single one of the municipalities when we report on them. And it tells you that this particular one is qualified this year, that one was qualified last year, and these are the areas, and we did it because it's a schedule, so we kind of say, irregular expenditure, my total municipality, tick. So which means that when you go through the financial statements, if you do get to that of my total, the things that will confront you in the financial statements will largely be that which has been teeth in the schedule in the annex. So it's a summarized annex, but it's more about saying A, B, C, D, E are the typical issues in this environment that have resulted in findings. But the detail of the narrative of the findings report, because of its size, is obviously not in the general report. That's what you could get from us when it's requested. But we have compiled a kind of a database of what it outcomes so that you can see by province, as well as you can see in the provinces themselves by municipality when that is happening. In fact, we do have it also electronically in our data, what is it, in our app on the website. And that's the easiest place because then you don't have to request it from us. You access it via the website on the app, and you can, if you need assistance, we can provide that assistance. And I think it links to the point that the Chair was raising about us embracing the need to provide some support to parliamentarians so that even that which is available electronically, they can seek support through their support functions to others. But we do have all of this information. We are more than happy to assist where needed. The value add of internal audits and audit committees leaves a lot to be distinct. right. leaves a lot to be desired. I was looking for that word. Right. Internal audit is not committee's chair. I think if I look at the overall combined resource model, I think they can do better. However, if one looks at particularly internal audit is a funny one because internal audit is supposed to be the tool that management has at their disposal within the entity. People that wake up every day and come to work as internal auditors. The trouble about this thing, if one looks at it inherently as well, is that it's that function that is budgeted for by an accounting officer in terms of its capacity, in terms of the scope of work that it can actually try and do. And sometimes it can possibly also stretch where it will there and go places that the accounting officer might not need and all that. So it's always a troublesome relationship. It's not independent of the accounting officer, but it's got a fun role that also has to check upon the accounting officer in many ways. And the question is, how does one streamline that relationship? Because you might end up with an internal audit function that looks like it's got all the people that it has, but it's got limited capacity to do the work that it has to do internally. Why? Because the resources are allocated by the person who might be struggling with what this particular function might service if it has to report about its findings to an independent chair of the audit committee. And that, I think, sometimes is a tension, and that's why internal audits find it difficult to pursue the work that they need to do with a lot of effectiveness, because they are stuck from a governance point of view in a place where I rely on my progress and support and all manner of things relating to resources as well as having access to the audit environment, let's say in a particular department. But when I have to deal with issues that are sensitive and causing tension in terms of what comes out of the internal review of the systems, I've got a competing conflict with the fact that I might be reporting about things that are under the eye and supervision of the person who's responsible for my own supervision. And I think we haven't teased out that part. Sometimes it works in the private sector because you've got strong audit committees where an audit committee chair has got a line of sight directly into the head of internal audit, and the head of internal audit doesn't really worry about the overbearing relationship of the accounting officer because they've got a line of reporting to an independent audit committee chair. To what extent the level of skills and capacity of even those functions have been given the necessary resources to lift them to that level, I think it's still a moot point. We probably might need to engage with what are the institutional mechanisms that make for a strong internal audit in the public sector. It's a question, Chair, that I think would need for the examination. The report from IRBA, as well as their latest assessment, will certainly provide that report. We do have a report. They normally give us a written report which tells us what their overall conclusion is. Annual workshop with all the MPs, we know this, Chair, and just want to say that last week we were presenting our audit outcomes for this year at the SICAS Forum, and there was a similar sentiment that was addressed, Chair, whereby, for example, suggestions to the effect that it might be a good idea to partner with the audit office whereby legislatures can help in engaging and taking matters to communities as well, between legislatures, the AG, and so on, to start using their role as legislators to try and get the message across, because they were recognizing the fact that quite a lot of people have got an appetite for understanding what audits, but the starting point with audits, you start with the definitional issues and other things which are not proper English sometimes, you know, and you, when I say not proper English, I mean the technical nuance that's sitting in a particular word from an audit point of view sometimes means something different when you think in pure English. So we welcome this. We will certainly, it's not outside of our strategic plan, definitely. It's part of actually enhancing the engagement plan for our stakeholder work. So if called upon to commit to doing this, Chair, it will really be a question of finding the appropriate mechanism and time to do it. All right. Then the occupancy rate, as well as why we allow 10% vacancy rate and so on. We came from a history, Chair, where we had substantial levels of vacancies in a number of places in the office, and this is where we say that for all the roles that we have identified in terms of the strategy plan, which we developed, say, 18 months before we actually implement, we all the roads that we've identified, we know that there are some that we will deliberately not go for, because our experience that year will be suggesting that we really don't need to bring those identified roads into the system. Others will just be sheer slow down in recruiting, but also people leaving the organization at different times and so on. So there will always be that gap. We will never have a fully fledged kind of 100% vacancy. However, what I can say is that with this rate of occupancy sitting at this level, we have never struggled to provide the necessary work that we need to do, and we keep it because of the buffer that we know will happen. And it's just the reality that either we didn't succeed in getting the numbers at the time that we went, or we've had more people leaving and the filling of those vacancies has been slow. But it always revolves around that number, and we think that it doesn't pose a risk in terms of the ability to deliver. And then the last one was a correlation between long outstanding debt versus audit outcomes. There is no direct correlation, but in terms of these ones are the ones that have got quite a lot of negative audit outcomes. And you look at the history of those amounts owing, I mean, you look at one that always sticks in my mind, is a municipality in the northwest, Fenderdorp. It's been owing forever in the day, big amounts of money. It's always had some negative audit accounts, and the list of them in the Northern Cape, in the Northwest, and some in the Free State as well as in the Eastern Cape, you will find that where their amounts have not been paid over a period of time, their audit outcomes have not been coming out strongly. Also, the issue about the extent of the amounts owing is sometimes linked to this, because these are situations where you go to a faraway place, having been told that the trial balance is ready for audit, and when the auditors arrive, then there's no trial balance. So there are a lot of inefficiencies that are non-audit related inefficiencies that end up becoming a major cost for the audit. Barring the one, Chair, that I was going to ask the Deputy to speak to regarding the allocations of National Treasury at 35%, I think I covered quite a bit of, if not all of them. Do you want to finish that one?
The gap, I think there will always be a gap because the National Treasury budgets for this number a good 8 months ahead. And we calculate at a point in time once all the audits are concluded. But yes, I do acknowledge that the gap has been increasing. And quantitatively, it's because of the cost of audits that have been increasing. Some of the issues the AG alluded to earlier on in terms of the skills within these small municipalities, small, very small auditees, the museums, etc., that just don't have the skills to keep up with the growing requirements in terms of reporting standards. Some of the standards have also been increasing at such a pace that municipalities and small municipalities can't catch up. So their ability to meet those requirements is constrained. Therefore, the audit inefficiencies also build. So it's about really the onerous reporting requirements for some of these small auditees. It's about the skills issues within these small auditees, which then jointly conspire to increase the cost of audit in each system.
Anybody with a second bite? And it will be the last bite. So let's maybe start with Ms. Carter. We'll come all the way this side. We'll allow anybody you have. Otherwise, you just pass on. Yes, ma'am.
Actually, mine is not specifically what we've got in front of us, okay, but if we go to your website, in 2013, there was a total of 24 investigative reports published. In 2014, there was nothing published, and in 2015, one. So I just want to try and find out, if we look at the investigative reports that were issued in 2013, is it extra work that was given that the department actually looked at, or that Auditor General looked at? And does it mean that in 2014 there was absolutely nothing that came in 2015 only one? Thank you.
Chair, normally just to say thank you very much. I think it's very, very comprehensive responses. But I think the one aspect about concepts that the AG spoke about is very important for MPs and for non-MPs. And I'll tell you why. Some of my friends in a rural municipality were invited to a party on a Friday afternoon that this municipality was holding. And so I said, why are you going to the party? They said, no, the Auditor General has given a report to our municipality, and we qualified, so we're having a party.
Just one from my side, AG. Your your slide on your funding principles. Are we to believe? Yeah, that one. Are we to believe that if all things are equal, and you've done a pretty accurate forecasting, that if the unconnected debt from municipalities or anybody exceeds 31 million rand, we're going to be in red in that year. Is that what we say? In other words, our gap for uncollectible debts is 31 million rand. Is that it? And if that is correct, what happens if we don't, or what happens if the uncollected debt is 60 million rand? Does that mean that we're going to compromise on some of our work? Because you estimated that our audit income is going to be 3 billion at a direct cost of return, I mean, 2 billion. After everything is said and done, we probably said that they should call it a net profit at the end of the day of 31 million rand. What happens if our revenue drops by more than 31 million rand? Does that mean that we are somehow going to be a non going concern? I mean, that's always been my problem, that we have to ensure that we never get to the stage where the Auditor General can't do his work because the auditees have not come to the party. Because you don't get any other direct revenue from the fiscus. So you rely entirely on what you get paid. If somehow Mr. Singh decides to go to all those rural areas he's talking about and tell them to deliberately not pay you, you could be in trouble if that amounts to more than 31 million rand. Is that what you're saying in this report? And if that's what you're saying, what is the contingency? That's basically what I'm saying. I don't want a situation where for the whole year the Auditor General can't open it because somebody didn't pay. If you want to make a comment on that one, and then on the investigative box side from Mr. Singh, I mean from Ms. Carter.
Thank you. Firstly, the investigative reports. We came from a period a couple of years ago where investigations used to come flooding in our direction as the audit office. Flooding as in they would come directly from the institutions, they would come from outside and so on. At that time it was possibly before the likes of the SIU, as well as the public protector had assumed public prominence in the area of investigations. There was a time that we used to absorb quite a bit of that. And we started saying that because these natural players in the area of investigating are now in place, perhaps it's time for us to redirect our efforts and not to focus on this, because we don't market investigations work, because that's not what our primary mandate is, although we do have investigations as a function. And so we said, let's not kill the capacity that we had. Let's keep it. But we will utilize those people who've got investigative and forensic skills. We'll utilize them throughout the processes of our audits. So what those people normally do, instead of getting involved in reports and trying to put on our letterhead an investigation on matters that sometimes are too difficult for us to make a call on, we are using those investigative skills that we have to partner with our regularity auditors. And the reason we are doing this is to make sure that when a regularity audit looks at the risks in a particular environment, they are better placed to have a much bigger insight and impact on the risks in that environment. If somebody with a forensic knowledge is also helping them look at how to test certain of those transactions. So we are using them internally to enhance the product of the regularity audit. So the lesser number of investigative reports is largely the reason for that. And in fact, there were many other requests that have come forth as well to us, like they normally get announced in the papers where people say, we have asked the Auditor General to investigate A, B, C, and D. A lot of those we actually don't ignore. We go right back once we receive correspondence from the people who write to us and say to them, having evaluated this request, well, that's another responsibility that we have, is that when we receive a request as an audit office, because that's not our primary mandate, we ought to evaluate this request in the light of other factors that are important for it. And so I think the rate at which we have rejected certain investigation requests, Chair, has also been quite high in the most recent part. The reason for it is because we looked at this and we said to ourselves, we do not have the resources, the capabilities, nor the insight to be able to make a pronouncement on, for example, something like the hiring of aeroplanes for moving soldiers from here to Central Africa. It requires quite a lot of other knowledge about other things before you can make a call on that. So we've been having quite a lot of them, but we've been rejecting them because we felt when we looked at this from a policy point of view that it's going to be one of those things that's going to put us in sort of trouble. Another one, just as an example, Chair, when the pressure report was tabled by the public protector, just around the same time, as we made 2 days or so before, we already received a request to also go do an investigation. And our view was that one of the things that defeats the real objective of an investigation is when you start with multi-agencies investigating the same case, because then you're going to end up with lots and lots of reports which need to be reconciled and all of that are around the same subject. So that's the issue around our investigation process. And I think that over a period of time, you're going to see less of them. We do respond and do others that we believe are within our capabilities, but we exercise sometimes the right to not get involved, especially if somebody else is doing it, or we believe that it will probably be just an exercise in futility if we try it. Because some of these things, they don't just require you to have appreciation of financial management disciplines, although that is the final measure of how things were done. But some of these investigations, they require you to have the core technical skills that potentially must be above those of the people who are doing the thing that is being investigated. Most of the time you can't have that, especially if it's not your specialty. Otherwise, where do people get exposure and training for it to keep up to date? Lastly, the issue of the cost is the cost were to go beyond the one that we are aiming for as a surplus chair. And let's say somebody makes a decision and say that all these auditees are now going to be audited elsewhere. If there's a massive thing that shows that, certainly it will impact us if we've got less and less, because it means that the fixed cost of employment that we need to meet will continue to be a fixed cost of employment, and there's no shortcut to that. But if someone said, let's close the tab now and 80% of these auditees will no longer be audited, but I'm just using an extreme example. However, if the deviation from those budgets is small, typically, because we're planning something that may or may not materialize, it may be exactly this or less or more. In that context, we've developed a mechanism, obviously, to say that continuity of operations is important. What is important for us is to meet the variable cost of employment, which is what we are showing there. If you look at the variable cost of employment being the people that we have employed, the contract work, that's the minimum. The rest of the other stuff, it's a question of once we come to that result, we now have to get into some tightening processes to tighten issues of fixed cost in order to make sure we can live within the margin. So I think the major important measure for us is when we submitted the funding model, having done an exercise spending a number of years, we said our margin, which is the difference between the revenue that we raise as well as the recovery of the direct costs of producing that work, if we maintain it at somewhere around 30-33% on average, then we're still in the game. And our experience has been over the years that we have consistently achieved that percentage guide, as it were, in terms of the margin. Then the rest up below the margin is a question of what is your appetite to change certain of the ways you do things in order to slow down the fixed cost. So we will always be alert to that. That's why we produce quarterly and monthly accounts, so that we can constantly assess the direction. Unfortunately, the people who run our business units across the board have got their finger on the pulse on this, because they have to account for the resources. And the budgets that are put in here are revenue estimates based on their experience and the work they do. So we've got another layer at the bottom that will alert us to anything going wrong in any part of the country when it comes to the revenue generation. So we've got an instrument to be proactive and respond to it should that happen. But our experience here over the last 4 or 5 years since we have been operating this funding model, we haven't had any serious challenges in that regard, unless there must be something that comes with a much tighter fiscal environment, which will translate into the recovery risk, which I think we've all already identified and are putting in place measures to deal with it should someone not pay us. But when it comes to the efficient delivery of work being the generated value versus what you put in it, I think that area is largely settled. We haven't changed our parameters in terms of the mix of the people that will go on audit in a big way, which means that we are likely to still be on course for the projected 32% of gross profit. Thank you.
AG and your team, thank you very much, and to the members. Just before we close, just to indicate the members that we now today receive the strat plan and budget. I guess we'll go and mull over it, take it to your caucus and do whatever needs to be done. Then we have, I think, maybe one or two sets of minutes that we will have to approve, and then, of course, our oversight report that we'll have to approve. So we are going to have a short meeting. We are on the 27th. Before the 27th, we'll have a short meeting just to adopt all these documents. So please go and apply. And then, Mr. Ramrock, if members can, in good time, get whatever set of minutes are outstanding and the oversight report, hopefully before the 27th, we'll set up a meeting where we'll just adopt these sets of minutes. So therefore, AG, by the 27th of November, you'll have an indication where the Parliament accepts or rejects or requests amendments is that time. So if you gave us, or if you bear with us for the next 3 weeks, you'll certainly get an indication. We will definitely meet before the 27th. So as members of the committee, we have one more meeting before we rise this year. The AG, I don't think we will see until next year. And if that's the case, then may you guys have a good rest and be ready for us in 2016. But I see some indication maybe we'll have a last word from Carter and then Mr. Do you want to say something, Ms. Carter? Okay. All right.
I don't want to be out of order because I know you've moved on. Okay. I just want to, especially if we talk about investigative reports. But that, for example, I want to use a municipality. I want to say the senior municipality had an external forensic audit in 2011. So you would, from resolutions and council resolutions and what's been in the media, etc., you'll know that there was a forensic audit. So if that AG goes in, do they insist on actually seeing the forensic audit, or is it something that you just stay away from simply? The reason I'm asking it is because you get situations where that municipality specifically is one, where you've had the MM resign, you've had the CFO resign, but the forensic audit has never seen the day of light, has never been released to the public.
And Jack, ideally on your date before the 20th, before we actually, the plenary is not for the week after.
No, thanks. The process of an audit, if we are aware of the existence of a forensic audit, when we go to plan the audit for next year and we didn't have that audit report the previous year, our requirements are that you must start with those reports. Only problem is when it has not been tabled in council, for example, and it was done by another external agency. Then sometimes there's trouble with using something like that because it could be somebody who's part of council but with other intentions wants us to look at this. But the question is, what is the authority of this report that you are giving to us if it has not been processed to council? So that's standard for us to say. When we do an initial risk assessment, we look at, because those issues are important that are contained in the report. They may be pointing us to areas of internal control where there are significant weaknesses. Some places have got issues in petty cash management, but you find that a lot of their money gets processed through petty cash. But petty cash may be a non-issue somewhere else. So we do look at them. In fact, our audit teams are required to put that at the top.
DG, you can then have your closing words, and we will then adjourn, if there's any, for you and your team.
No, thank you very much, Chair. We appreciate the engagement with the committee, and as the committee knows, we have said that we will do our best to try and put necessarily leave us in the machinery that we have as an audit office. And this thing that we do sometimes has got its own troubles. And we try as hard as we can to navigate through those things, you know, especially when there's undue pressure that is put, particularly the case that was cited earlier on. So we're hoping, Chair, that what we are putting out in this strategic plan is going to resonate with what is expected of our institution. And when we test it, we see other institutions elsewhere that are similar to us doing similar kind of things. So thank you, Chair, and I also want to use this opportunity in the committee to thank the Deputy AG for having led the team that has produced this, the leadership in terms of the National Leader for Audit Services, Eugene Zungu, and Barry Margot, who heads up our corporate services portfolio of audits. Thank you to them and the teams that they lead, because the more clarity we provide in terms of what we do, the more we can also help in becoming the example for those that we audit. Thanks so much.